This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Alfredo Hurtado does not do things half-heartedly. When he played soccer as a kid, he ended up in an Adidas World Cup commercial. And when he learned to play guitar, it was Alfredo rocking out to La Vida Loca to student audiences across the East Coast. So when Alfredo decided to join the military, he went all in, became a paratrooper and a member of military police unit that deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq during the global war on terror. His journey left him wounded, but also deeply appreciative of what his body can do and what it means to be human. After a long struggle, his family, along with music and movement, helped him recover. Alfredo is co-founder and now a dancer with the Black Box Dance Theater in Raleigh. He uses music and movement to express himself and help others do the same, and he joins me today. Welcome to State of Things, Alfredo.
Thank you, Frank, for having me.
I want to know more about your childhood in New Jersey, playing soccer and all of that, and coming from parents who migrated to the United States. But I want to start out with your decision to join the military. Talk about that.
So I had just started dating my wife, and I needed to get serious and kind of rebuild my discipline and structure so that I can be a responsible adult. So my wife and I were working out one day, and it's called West Hudson Park in Harrison, New Jersey. And I brought up the idea of maybe joining the Army. And she told me she was nuts. She had done ROTC. She's like, don't even think about it. It's crazy. So anyway, the next morning she calls me up and she says, yeah, I just talked to a recruiter. He wants to talk to you.
And so, wait a minute. You're kind of talking you out of it.
Kind of. Yeah. But she thought maybe, hey, this probably would work for him. Yeah. So the recruiter said, we're looking for MPs. And I said, great. That's what I wanted to do. One of my childhood dreams was to be a fireman, a police officer, mm-hmm. and a soldier. And mm-hmm. so I said, hey, I could kill two birds with one stone, right? So I joined in 2000, and I went to the recruiting station in Fort Hamilton, New York. And I did pretty well on my ASVAB, and they offered me to do counterintelligence. And so I jumped on it. I was like, hey, I could be James Bond, right? I could do some kind of espionage stuff. This would be great. So unfortunately, due to one of the top secret questions, clearance questions, disqualified me. And the question was, are you a dual citizen? And at the time, I thought I was a dual citizen. It ended up that I wasn't. My mom had did all the paperwork, but the requirements for it to be valid, you had to live in Colombia for 2 years. And that never happened. I was born and raised in Jersey, right? So in order for me to disprove that, I had to do all this stuff. And I said, you know what? I'll just go back to the MP job. And one of the recruiters was like, you know, you want to be an MP? You want to be sitting around eating donuts, sitting in a patrol car all day? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, well.
It sounds good.
That sounds okay.
And I get paid, right?
He's like, you think you'll be doing that, being a paratrooper? You'll be down at Fort Bragg. You'll be deployed the first 6 months. Yeah. And I was like, look at this guy trying to talk me out of this great gig of being an MP, you know? And he was so right. He was absolutely right. I got to Bragg May of 2001 and then 9/11.
Yeah. Yeah, so it you might have had a few more donuts out of the deal, but then 9/11 happened. So what happens next?
What happens next is I was actually out doing some training with my unit, and we had been called in to guard the gate. So we did it 72 hours, no rest, no sleep. So there were times of hallucination. You know, I saw my friends from Jersey sitting on my Humvee, and I was like, wait a minute, what's going on here? And, you know, my sergeant was like, hey, take a rest. And he's out doing his thing, and I hear him swearing up a storm. And so, but it was tough. We ended up going to the Pentagon September 19th, 2001. It was an amazing convoy, over 100 vehicles. And the most amazing thing was when we were getting close to the Pentagon, it was traffic, complete traffic, standstill on each side. We were getting escorted by the state troopers. And people started getting out of their cars and, like, honking the horns, mm-hmm. and you saw flags. I mean, this is a devastating time for us, but it was amazing because of how everyone was just coming together for this. And so I had some tears, some chills, and then it started hitting me, like, what we're doing, what we're here for. And so I spent about 7 months at the Pentagon.
That must have been a sight. I mean, you probably got to see things that the rest of us didn't. We saw the outside, but what was that like to be inside the Pentagon looking at that wreckage?
It was, the inside was, I mean, the smell of the burn, like the char and the fuel, and it was kind of spooky. It was really spooky, really desolate, really, I mean, it just felt, you know, just not right.
Well, eventually you did find yourself in both Afghanistan and later Iraq, and I want to talk more about your military service, but now I do need you to take me back to growing up in New Jersey. And the fact is your parents both did come from Colombia. They migrated here. They were immigrants to this country. And your dad really wanted to assimilate. He was a guy who saw, you know, every celebration as a way to become more American, right?
Oh, yeah. He made us appreciate everything this country has to offer, right? And he wanted to come here, you know, the dream, make money, family. But he's much more than that. And what he was able to do for us was to expose us to what, I mean, I grew up a few minutes out of Manhattan. I could jump on the PATH train and it'll take me right into New York. And so he wanted to take advantage of that, full advantage. And, you know, we went up to Empire State Building and the Botanical Gardens in Brooklyn, Times Square, the Museum of Natural History, just some amazing places that he took us to. And you know, he was a laborer. He actually, he pressed coats at a textile factory for most of my life. And so we didn't have much. But what we did have was, you know, right all around us, the culture of where we were at was amazing.
Including music. And so you used to get a musical instrument, did you buy
yes.
once a year?
For every Christmas, my dad would buy me something, a small drum set, a keyboard. But I somehow managed to destroy it. You know, I became a rock star before I could play, right? Destroyed all my instruments. But on my 14th my 14th birthday, he was like, okay, I'm taking you to the flea market. This is it. This is the last thing I'm getting you. So it was a classical nylon string guitar. And so we went, I think we paid a few bucks for it, no case. I bought it home. And that day I actually was watching MTV and there was music on. And Great White was covering Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You from Led Zeppelin. And I said, I need to learn how to play that. So I just taught myself how to play and eventually I learned it.
I'm talking with Alfredo Hurtado today on The State of Things. You did, and then you ended up getting pretty serious about music, right? Talk about what happens next.
So, I you know, through practice and stuff, I auditioned for a musical group called Exposure Motown Review. And, you know, we covered Motown hits. And one of my first performances was actually here in UNC Wilmington. And it was, please forgive me, I can't remember the hurricane, but it was in 99. But I got to come down and play guitar with these amazing artists. But it was kind of it was fun. It was kind of funny too. But so I was the only Hispanic in this all African American group, and so they thought it was a great idea to do Ricky Martin's La Vida Loca.
Hey, let's let the Spanish kid do that one.
And it was great. Such a great reception. So much fun. It helped me with my confidence and know that my ability to be an artist was definitely appreciated.
So you're thinking about this. Now, this is long before. We're taking us back before this decision to, you know, you're going out with your wife, you meet the recruiter, and you actually join the Army. But this is years ahead of that, a few years ahead of that. Were you thinking about a career in music at that point?
I when I started playing, I wanted to be a rock star, right? Yeah. I wanted to be this famous, you know, I wanted to be Jimmy Page and David Gilmour. You need to practice like 20 hours a day to do that. But I just wasn't there. I didn't have the discipline I needed to get to that point. But I did, you know, I was in a band, I was in a group, and I performed. But so the timing of it all was I met my wife, or we started dating, because we actually went to high school together. Mm-hmm. But we dated after high school. But I met her and I felt that being a musician wasn't going to be able to support a family. So I did the next best thing, what any sane person would do, and it's join the Army, right?
Well, that's interesting. And you realize, this is not going to work out. I need some discipline. That'll work. She first tells you you're crazy, and then she calls the recruiter and says, yeah, this might work. So you do that. And by the way, it was Hurricane Floyd. Turns out
yes.
that was Hurricane Floyd.
Thank you.
That's in the aftermath of that. So you do get deployed. You talked about the, you know, one of the first gigs is you end up at the Pentagon immediately after 9/11. And then your first deployment to Afghanistan. Talk about that.
At first, it was a difficult deployment. I had to be away from my family. It was tough. My daughter was 11 months old, so I missed first birthday, first everything. I was grateful enough to see her born. I mean, that was an amazing gift, and I'm grateful for that. And I missed a lot of firsts, and that's fine because she doesn't remember it, which mm-hmm. is good, and I do, but still. It was an interesting, amazing deployment. I got there December 2002, and when the plane landed, I had thought I'd either gone back in time a few thousand years or the plane crashed and I was in hell somehow. I don't know. But that's how I felt the moment. And then once we got out and being there for a while, exploring the country, doing patrols, going into the villages, meeting the people, we did a lot of humanitarian work. So there was a lot of contact with locals. And what an amazing group of people, hardened. You know, their life is really rough. It's crazy because all I saw were cars and maybe a couple of cell phones, but there were no cities like yeah. over here, and just a lot of mud huts and villages like that. Even the Kandahar, which is a big city, was pretty bad.
We'll talk about that and your deployment to Iraq and what happened afterward with Alfredo Hurtado, who founded and co-founded and is now a dancer with the Raleigh-based Black Box Dance Theater. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Alfredo Hurtado started his career with a specific skill set. It included jumping out of planes and carrying an assault rifle. Today, his job demands much different movements, the expressive and graceful motions of a dancer. Alfredo Hurtado is co-founder, collaborator, and dancer with the Raleigh-based Black Box Theater and my guest today. We talked about your deployment to Afghanistan. You said you felt like you were going back in time. When you get off that plane, you start meeting the people and notice how difficult life is and are amazed at their ability to adapt and to live this hard life. Part of your job there, too, was guarding detainees, right? So talk yes. more about that.
So we had rotations, and one of the rotations was the prison camp. And they would bring in, we never had maybe more than five or six at a time, because they were always passing through to go to Bagram or wherever they were sending them. But I was in charge of my shift, and you know, it's kind of weird when you see somebody and they're known to be some kind of mass murderer or some crazy criminal, but you're staring at this person in their most vulnerable state and saying, how is this possible, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it was a tough job. One of the interesting things about the job was we got to fly with them to Bagram, and a lot of these guys have never been on a plane. And that is an amazing sight to see, and the smell is definitely not.
It affected their tummies.
Yes.
Yeah.
A few of them gotten sick.
It's sort of amazing to think about that juxtaposition. But the empathy you felt, and it is true. I mean, you understand intellectually they have done bad things. They maybe have hurt friends of yours, and so you get that part of it. But they're not doing that now, right? They're sitting there with their hands behind their back.
Right.
It must be a sort of an emotionally, I would think, curious place to be, to start feeling empathy, because you almost have to. It's a human being, and they're not doing that thing that they, you know, they must have done.
Right, but it doesn't mean that I kept my guard down.
Oh yeah,
because these guys at any second could turn around and kill me.
But that's what I mean. Rushing to you, because you understand that this is really dangerous. It really mm-hmm. is, but it doesn't look dangerous. And now they look kind of human to me.
Yeah.
So, but your deployment then, you were ultimately deployed to Iraq, right?
Yes.
You went to Iraq. And that, you said, was very different.
It was. Before we got to Iraq, we went to Kuwait for a couple of weeks to, you know, get our weapons ready and just kind of like get our equipment ready to go. Kuwait was an interesting country because it's like a humongous beach where I was at and there was no water. So that's confusing already. I'm like, what's going on here? But the Kuwaiti people are amazing. Their reception of us was just wonderful. Being able to interact with them is great. And then we staged after our time in Kuwait, we staged at the border of Iraq and convoyed all the way up. We thought we were going to Baghdad, victory. And that changed. We ended up in FOB Kasu, which was south of Baghdad in Alexandria. And upon our arrival the first night, we grounded our gear, and a lot of our stuff wasn't there because they were in Connexes and they hadn't made it through yet. Mm. So we were just whatever we had on our backs. And in a tent made of plywood and a half-shelf tent, and on the floor with not even a sleeping bag. And, you know, after, you know, messing around a little bit before we went out and our sergeant told us to shut our mouths, it got quiet. And it was too quiet. And I heard the most unusual and frightening sound I've ever heard in my life. And it was a very faint thump. And what followed was like one of the worst things ever. And it was a mortar attack. And so we just bolted out. I mean, we kind of knew what was going on. And it had really never happened at that capacity for us. We had been rocketed attacked in Afghanistan. But this was just a whole new ball game. And it was just one right after the other. So we ended up running into our bunkers, and it was like that for the next few days. We were just getting mortared every night. And at one point I was like, you know what? I'd rather be on patrol. I'd rather be out there than just sitting here and sleeping. And kind of thinking back at it, going in your sleep is not such a bad thing either. But at the time I was like, there's no way I'm going out like that. You know, I need to do something.
Well, and it's interesting just to get the sensory experience of this, because we're going to talk more about how you integrated sense experience in dance and work through some of the things that have followed your deployments. But the difference between a mortar and an RPG, just from your point of view, how it sounds, right?
Yes. So RPG is like, hey, I'm coming here. This is the direction I'm going. And a mortar is pretty much, you know, somebody gets a bow and arrow, they shoot it up in the air, and then it's like, where is it going to land? Yeah. You know, you don't hear anything.
And that soft thump that you know is disaster in about a half a second.
Yes.
Wow. So you did eventually you did go out on missions, right? Describe the missions that you were doing there.
So one of my first jobs when I got there was to be the commander's detail. Our company commander would go out on missions and patrols. Sometimes we go, you know, support a platoon or do some kind of mission. Mm-hmm. So actually one of the deadliest days when I was there, April 11th, 2004, excuse me. Mm. And, one of our platoons had made contact, and, our commander was like, let's go help him out. And so we were out there for quite a few hours. And I just remember driving into it, you know, seeing all the smoke and people just leaving, like tons of people just driving out and leaving. I looked over the vehicle, and I just remember seeing a guy, I stared right in his eyes, and he did that motion where, you know, he drags his finger right under your neck, right?
This is one of the civilians driving out of this town, right? Iraqi civilians. Yeah. Wow.
And I it was blown away. I was like, oh my goodness, what am I going into? Right? Yeah. And so we get there, and we dismounted, and when we dismounted, just the rounds were hitting off the floor and whizzing by us, and we just got back in the truck, and we let our big guns do the work, and we had some air support from the Marines and some ground support from them as well. But we call it Bloody Sunday. It's a pretty rough day, but fortunately none of us were even injured. But about a few days later, because it had gotten quiet after that, and that's not really a good sign. A few days later, we were on patrol. It was April 16th, and we were coming up to a village, and it was about 8 o'clock at night, so all the lights were on, and then suddenly all the lights in the village went off, all at the same time, and RLT was just like, get out of here. Let's go. Move. And I was the second to last vehicle in the convoy. I had a vehicle behind me. There were maybe 50 to 100 meters, maybe, let's say, about 80 yards apart, and I'm driving, and I'm looking out the window, and the next thing I know, I'm waking up in a truck full of smoke, and it was hot, and I was running through a million scenarios at that moment of what just happened to me, and the first thing I did was I turn around, I asked my guys if they were all right, and they all responded that they were, And then I felt the blood just trickling down to my face. And I just started screaming it, losing it, telling them, get out of here, let's go, move, and calling on the radio. I'm hit and I'm injured. And, my injuries were pretty not that bad compared to my guys. And both my guys got injured really bad. But fortunately enough, they survived and they came back home and they have their lives and they're doing great. But it was just a horrible and interesting experience to go through that.
Well, what happened next, though? You did have to recover.
I did have to recover, but what made the whole situation worse was actually getting to Germany from there. We took a helicopter, or we took a Black Hawk to Baghdad, and on the way there, I'm seeing muzzle flash, you know, from the ground. And I have no weapon. I'm wearing a pair of pants and boots. My head's covered, and I have two guys on here with me that can't even move, and they're blue. Like, these guys are completely blue. So my thought at that point was, okay, if this thing goes down, I want it to blow up and burn, and that's it. And then if it doesn't and I survive, I'm going to fight until I die, but I'm not getting captured. I refuse to get captured. You know what was going on with all those guys that got captured, and there's no way I could have went through that. So I would have tried. I would have died fighting, that's for sure. And then again, it happened on my way from Baghdad to Balad. Same thing with the muzzle flash. And I'll tell you what, the most beautiful sight that I've ever seen in my life is when that back hatch opened up from that C-141, and I was in Germany to see those hills and the green, and just the sun was just it was amazing. But it was horrible just to see all those young guys and that bird with me coming back, and then just seeing them, you know, it's the revolving door in a hospital, right?
But you did, there was this did have a lingering effect, even though the injuries, as you say, were not terribly serious. And you had this moment of, you know, sort of in a sense elation or euphoria when you can get to Germany. But this did start a kind of downward spiral for you.
I just started taking a lot of meds because I thought that's what I was supposed to do, because that's what's going to make me feel better. And it got to a point where, you know, like 2010, I just didn't feel like it was necessary to move on if I'm going to be like this. If I'm going to be on pills my whole life, I'm going to be zonked out. I'm going to mess up my internal organs. I'm going to do all this stuff. There has to be another solution to this. So 2010, I wanted to take my own life. And thank goodness my wife was there, and she helped me get to the hospital. And I spent about a week there, and they had actually cut my meds down to one pill. And I was on that pill for about a year and a half, and then I haven't needed to take anything since.
What was your relationship like with your wife and your daughter at this time in that period as you're finding yourself in this spiral?
Well, there was a point where my wife thought that I should leave. You know, go and stay with your family, kind of like rediscover something or figure something out, because it wasn't healthy for my daughter to see me like that. And so I ended up going away for a little while, too long. And I may have been enlightened. And when I came home, I became more aggressive with my recovery and finding alternative ways of getting better.
One of those alternatives was writing, right? At your wife's suggestion, was it?
Yes. So when I came back, she gave me a leather-bound book and said, here, this is yours. Just write in it. You know, write your story. Write whatever you want. No one's going to hear it. No one's going to listen to it. No one, nothing, right? Yeah, sure. But anyway, and so I did. But I just started noticing this interesting flow when I was writing. And, you know, being a musician, I was like, oh, I could put some music behind this and, you know, maybe something will happen. And I'm not saying they're Grammy award winning, you know, tunes, but it was just how I felt, how I felt was coming out of me. And in a way, it was so great and it was so therapeutic, but still, I was kind of isolated. I was very reclused in a room writing, recording. So some stuff was working. There was still something else missing. But because of this recording that I made, my wife decided to give it to Michelle Pearson. and Michelle Pearson is my mentor. And
what is why Michelle Pearson? What was she doing?
She is a local artist who, at the time, her son was in my wife's class. My wife taught in downtown Raleigh, and she slipped it to him because she knew about Michelle and what she did, and so she slipped it to her. And then Michelle listened to it, and then she was like, "Man, I got to meet this guy," right? So she called me up one day and said, "Hey, I listen to your CD and you know, I'm really interested in you know, meeting you. And so I'm going to Greenville. Would you like to come with me?" So I went with her, and I'm thinking this is my audition interview. And so we did some workshops. Our first one was at the children's ward at the hospital. And, you know, I got to play music while she was doing her performance and excuse me. And then we went to a senior home with a dance class from ECU, and we performed and did some stuff with the seniors there. And then we also visited a halfway home for teens. But the last one we did was inner city kids, and we did at the Arts Council in Greenville. And, you know, at this point, I was like, just no way I'm dancing. I'm a rock star. Rock stars don't dance unless I'm on stage. So there's no way I'm going to dance.
And by the way, they'd taken you off the drugs, so you know. Yeah.
I'm a rock and roller. I'm a musician. Right. And so anyway, if anyone, and for everyone that does know Michelle, she has a way of convincing you to do something, right? So she saw a pair of kids, and she's one of the dancers was pretty amazing, and she was like, "Hey, do you mind pairing up with him?" And I'm like, "Oh my god, I gotta put my guitar and I have to do all this stuff." But anyway, we got together and we were doing this thing, exercise called 1 to 10, where we create shapes around each other and then we build off of that. And so we built a little performance between the two of us, and she was, you know, she was so ecstatic about it, and I had no idea what I just did, but what I did made me feel awesome. Like, it was amazing because of that human connection, the contact, you know, collaborating, doing something together, being there for, you know, a common purpose.
I'm talking to Alfredo Hurtado today on The State of Things. So you were hooked on dance.
I was hooked, but I didn't start dancing until maybe a year later. So we were performing at schools, and while the dancers were having fun on stage, I mean, I was having fun too, but I was on side, I was playing music. But the way they were moving, their athletic ability, the finesse, just a combination of their movements and facial expressions. I was like, I need to have that all the time. I need to be involved in that. And so I did. I was in my head for a long time that I physically couldn't do anything because I was damaged goods. And this, like, chiseled away any of those thoughts and said, "Man, you're not done. You got a lot to do."
One of the things you did was to co-found the Black Box Dance Theater, and now one of the things that organization does is work with kids and other people in environments, not like war environments, but perhaps kids suffering from PTSD, right?
Right. We recently did a workshop in Yancey County, and it was based around a lot of emotional distress and a high suicide rate for elementary school kids.
A high suicide rate for elementary school kids in Yancey County.
It's sad, you know, when you hear about an 8-year-old committing suicide. Why? Why is this child feeling like this is the only solution to whatever's going on in their life? So we're just dancers. We're not therapists. Mm-hmm. We know that art is healing, and so we go over there to create art, to create something with these kids and allow them to express themselves. And, you know, we don't have the answers, but we can try to figure something out together, you know.
How do they respond to this, though? This might be different for them, very new. Do they take to it right away? And then what happens when they start getting involved? You see any change?
They don't stop telling you their story. They'll tell you their story. They gladly tell you everything. And, you know, that's hard. It gets hard on you after a while, because when you hear more than one kid telling a story that's tragic, it weighs on you. And physically, I might be able to do stuff. My mind at the end of the day is just I'm trying to wrap my head around it.
What do you think it is about motion, about movement and dance that works for you and appears to be useful and helpful to kids like those in Yancey County?
It makes me feel human, right? It's something that we are lacking, I believe. And it's only because we are part of a system that has to function and we all train in our trade. And that's, you know, we get identified by what we do. So we lose this whole thing with the arts where, you know, honestly, for me, the arts makes me feel like a child again, you know, that innocence, that to, the silliness, the goofiness, to be allowed to do that with no judgment, is what we need. And I think there should be more of it.
Thank you for every bit of your service. Thank you so much, Alfredo Hurtado. Alfredo is a co-founder and collaborator and dancer with the Black Box Dance Theater. He will be leading a dance workshop for veterans in December through the United Arts Council Vet Arts Program. And you can find out more about that at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, she's defending her seat on the North Carolina State Supreme Court. We'll talk with Justice Barbara Jackson in a moment. Stay with us.